My name is Michael McCusker. Well, I have a few things to read this morning, primarily based on the Occupy organizations all over the country and the world. And I'd like to begin with an article by Stephen Burke, which will appear in the November Hipfish. Power to the People. And Stephen Burke, of course, lives right here in Astoria. The spontaneous uprisings characterized by the Greek general strike, as well as the Occupy, and that's in quotes, movement that began with Occupy Wall Street and has spread virtually everywhere, indicate that a true crisis is now occurring in the neoliberal world order. This is the free trade race to the bottom regimen imposed on the world over the past 30 years by elite countries led by the United States. It began in earnest in the Reagan-Thatcher 1980s, when massive deregulation, deunionization, and privatization were imposed on formerly welfare state economies. These economies had previously regulated banking to keep the kinds of wild speculation that had led to the crash of 1929, the Wall Street crash, and the ensuing Great Depression from recurring. They also had strong unions protecting family wage jobs, partially through tariffs to prevent unfair competition from cheaply made foreign goods. The regulated capitalism that made the West prosperous after the Second World War and was gradually spreading to lesser developed countries was jettisoned as the ideas of Milton Friedman, dean of the Chicago School, economics took over. We now live with the fruit of that world order, a new robber baron economy dominated by what the populists of 1896 called the money power. Trade liberalization and deregulated banking have brought about a predatory system wherein CEOs of transnational corporations and titans of international finance have become multi-billionaires, while the world majority has been relegated to industrial or agrarian peonage or begging. The once robust U.S. industrial economy has been hollowed out, as cheap goods from China and other economies where workers make pennies an hour flood our market. Few Americans work in industry anymore, as most work in the low-wage, largely non-unionized service economy. American consumers are now as up to their ears in debt as were the farmers victimized by big banks and railroads in the hungry 1890s. And so, like their forebears of that era, they are rising up. The problem now, as then, is unregulated capitalism, which creates vast inequalities. The Tea Party movement, largely funded by billionaires like media giant Rupert Murdoch, blames government, chiefly the Obama administration, for bailing out the big banks. In fact, the bailout began under George W. Bush. But the real point is that the Tea Party, echoing the modern libertarian movement, likes to pretend that all bad flows from government and all good from the private sector. Libertarians are blind to the ever closer connection between government at all levels and transnational banks and corporations. In case there might be the slightest doubt, a conservative and libertarian-controlled Supreme Court issued the Citizens United decision in 2010, which guaranteed control of our political institutions by big capital. What Occupy Wall Street and like movements around the world see, which the Tea Party won't, is that the top 1% has bought up our political system. Thus, occupiers don't march on Congress, nor do they petition state legislatures, because they know that the politicians there represent the 1%, not the 99%. The Tea Party, on the other hand, has not only been closely connected to Congress and the state legislatures, but upon gaining power in 2010, having campaigned as faux populists, they immediately got to work making sure the 1% has it all. They delegitimized public unions in a number of states, passed legislation making it harder for students, the working poor, and unemployed to vote, and they stand in the way of federal jobs legislation that would compel the wealthiest to pay their fair share. The occupiers, for their part, have no specific legislative program. They occupy public space to bear witness for the 99% of people the world over who are being robbed by an order run by financial and corporate oligarchs. They set up alternative forms, a committee of the whole or general assembly, and do acts of mutual caring. "This is what democracy looks like," they chant, thereby giving the lie to our bought politics. They give life to a rallying cry of the oppressed I often heard in my youth, power to the people. And that was Stephen Burke. And if you wish to have a copy of this, pick up the November Hip Fish, which will very soon be out. And he writes, you know, he's a regular columnist for Hip Fish. So be on the look for it. It'll be on the stands, on the streets, pretty soon. And I'd like to continue with the 99% Rise Up. And this appeared in the October 31st edition of The Nation, and it was written by John Nichols. How did Occupy Wall Street suddenly become Occupy Los Angeles, Occupy Cleveland, Occupy Janesville, Occupy Pocatello, Occupy Seaside, Occupy Astoria, Oregon? How did a sleep-in beneath the skyscrapers of Lower Manhattan inspire kayakers clad as Robin Hood to paddle up the Chicago River under a banner reading, "Wall Street takes from the 99%, gives to the rich"? And how did those giant cutouts of J.P. Morgan, Chase, CEO, Jamie Dimon, end up dancing with all those San Franciscans chanting, "Make banks pay"? Despite what Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain suggests, it was not some orchestrated, and that's a quote, attempt to deflect blame from the flawed policies of the Obama administration. It was not the media looking for a left-wing tea party. And it certainly was not a poll-tested, focus-grouped PR campaign that billionaire-funded front groups employ to gin up movements. Occupy Wall Street started small, took a beating from the cops, and struggled for weeks to get the attention of the political class, the media, and even its own natural allies. The only thing going for this unlikely intervention has been the pitch-perfect resonance of its founding premises. The American people understood Occupy Wall Street and began to embrace its promise long before the mandarins, who presumed to chart our national discourse, noticed that anything or that everything was changing. That's because the generators of this movement, and it is a movement, have got three things right from the start. One, the target is right. This has been a year of agitation from Wisconsin to Ohio to Washington. It has seen some of the largest demonstrations in recent American history in defense of labor rights, public education, public services. But all those uprisings attacked symptoms of the disease. Occupy Wall Street named it, by aiming activism not at the government, but at the warren of bankers, CEOs, and hedge fund managers to whom the government is beholden. Occupy Wall Street went to the heart of the matter, and that captured the imagination of Americans who knew Michael Moore was right when he finished his 2009 documentary, Capitalism, A Love Story, with an attempted citizen's arrest of the bankers who not only avoided accountability after crashing the economy, but profited from a taxpayer-funded bailout. Like the populists, the socialists, and the best of the progressive reformers of a century ago, Occupy Wall Street has not gotten distracted by electoral politics. It has gone after the manipulator of both major parties, what the radicals of old referred to as the money power. Number two, the numbers are right. If Thomas Frank's What's the Matter with Kansas taught us anything, it was that the great accomplishment of the money power in contemporary politics has been to divide the overwhelming mass of Americans over social and cultural issues, thus deflecting attention from fundamental economic debates. The brilliance of Occupy Wall Street's message, "We are the 99%, is that it invites just about everyone who isn't a billionaire to recognize themselves as members of the class that has suffered what Thomas Jefferson once described as a long train of abuses and usurpations. For all the efforts of Wall Street's media and political defenders to dismiss the persistent protesters as somehow un-American, the vast majority of Americans recognize that kids in sleeping bags did not shutter this country's factories, mangle our mortgage markets, or create a pay-to-play system. The 99% did not ask for or approve a system that always has money for wars and bank bailouts, but won't, as former Congressman Alan Grayson notes, help the 24 million Americans who can't find full-time work, the 50 million Americans who can't see a doctor when they're sick, the 47 million Americans who need government aid to feed themselves, the 15 million American families who owe more on their mortgages than their homes are worth. And number three, the demands are right. The most comic complaint about Occupy Wall Street, not just from critics but even from some elite sympathizers, is that it lacks well-defined demands. In fact, the objection of the occupiers to a system of corporate domination and growing inequality, and their desire to change that system, makes a lot more sense to a lot more Americans than anything being said by politicians. Polling confirms this point. Barack Obama's approval ratings are dismal, but the approval ratings for the Republicans in Congress are dramatically worse. The American people desperately wanted this movement. That is proven not only by the polls, but by the practical embrace of the Occupy Wall Street ethos in more than 1,000 communities across the nation. Some are already occupying public spaces. Others are marching and rallying. Beyond Wall Street, there will be more specific complaints, more adventurous alliances, more practical politics, but there's no reason why a diversity of issues and tactics cannot build the movement that was invited when the call to Occupy Wall Street was issued. The key word is invited. The genius of Occupy Wall Street is that it is not a traditional political project. It did not arrive with a set of talking points and an organizing template. Its evolution has already taken it far from where it began, physically or politically. Its alliance with unions and other progressive groups will, in all likelihood, transform the movement as it spreads across the country, just as the movement has the potential to transform its allies. There will be ongoing occupations, but there's also the prospect of countrywide, indeed worldwide, days of action, like the one that was planned for October 29th in American capital cities and cities around the world, the weekend before the G20 summit in France, and the day of the great Wall Street crash of 1929. The prospect of massive demonstrations like the 1969 anti-Vietnam War moratorium, the immigrant rights demonstrations of 2006, and last winter's mobilizations in and outside the Capitol in Madison, Wisconsin, has already unsettled mainstream politicians and the pundit class that serves as their stenographers. New York Congressman Peter King told right-wing radio host Laura Ingraham, quote, "It's really important for us not to be giving any legitimacy to these people in the streets. I'm old enough to remember what happened in the 1960s when the left wing takes to the streets and somehow the media glorifies them and it ends up shaping policy. We cannot allow that to happen." And that was Peter King. But it is happening. That is exhilarating and necessary. Our political culture, as dysfunctional as it is disappointing, will change only if those in power feel threatened by movements that are impossible to manage. Already, the reactions to the threat are clarifying. The Republican Party, with rare exceptions, has rallied to defend the banksters, with Representative Paul Ryan fretting about sowing class envy, that's a quote, and Representative Eric Cantor warning that Americans might become a mob. And that's also a quote. Democrats have been more nuanced. President Obama says he understands the frustration of the protesters, and since advancing his jobs bill in September, he has moved in a more populist direction. But he still promotes free trade deals that will exacerbate the unemployment crisis, which fuels so much of the 99%ers' frustration. Other Democrats have been more consistent. Members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus and the Congressional Black Caucus have been predictably warm in their embrace of a populist movement that strengthens their hand in party debates. And House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi has risen repeatedly to defend the protesters, declaring, "I support the message to the establishment, whether it's Wall Street or the political establishment and the rest, that change has to happen. We cannot continue in a way that is not relevant to their lives." Pelosi's stance is commendable, yet it is an inadequate counter to the nearly universal Republican demand for more tax cuts, privatization, raging income inequality, and health care policies that tell the poor to die quickly. The Democratic Party is anything but united on behalf of a fair economy. In 2008, when everyone was ready to end the Bush era, Obama could cobble together a broad coalition to win the presidency. But that won't work now that the battle lines are drawn. "This is no time to hang back," says former Senator Russ Feingold. "One of the biggest problems Democrats have is that they forget the power and the passion that the base of the party has." The president can no longer satisfy both the CEOs, some of whom will see him as their best defense against the rabble, and the single moms. If he tries, the single moms will run out of patience. So it is that the Occupy Wall Street movement might well develop into a virtual primary challenge to Obama. Instead of coasting to renomination, the president could find himself confronted by protests from Iowa to New Hampshire to Nevada to California. Protests that would require him to move to the left just as a credible primary challenger might have done. Protests that could make next year's Democratic convention in Charlotte more than just a coronation. Getting Obama to take the side of 99% of Americans is smart politics for the Democrats. But that ought not to be the goal of the Occupy Wall Street movement. This fight is too important to be about one politician, one party, or one election. "Some people say we are the Tea Party for the Democratic Party," said Emilio Baez, a 17-year-old high school student who joined the Occupy Chicago protests. "That's BS. We are the working class for a mass movement of democracy." Baez is right. America needs a new politics as much of the streets as the polling place. A politics that, like the labor movement of the 1930s, the civil rights and anti-war movements of the 1960s, the environmental movement of the early 1970s, forces both parties to transform. Anything less is more of the same. More poverty, more inequality, more economic injustice. And if Occupy Wall Street is anything at all, it is a shout from the 99%ers. We have had it. And that's John Nichols. And that was an article in the October 31st, 2011, Nation, the 99% Rises. And from that same issue, the most important thing in the world, and a little bit of a lead into it, Nation columnist and shock doctrine author Naomi Klein visited Occupy Wall Street on October 6th and addressed the crowd. Since sound amplification is banned, she made a shortened version of her speech over the human microphone, with every few words repeated by hundreds of people. The full text of her speech, which also appeared in the second edition of the Occupy Wall Street Journal, is below, and that's from the editors of The Nation. And from Naomi Klein, "I love you." And I didn't just say that so that hundreds of you would shout, "I love you" back, though that is obviously a bonus feature of the human microphone. "Say unto others what you would have them say unto you, only way louder." Yesterday, one of the speakers at the labor rally said, "We found each other." That sentiment captures the beauty of what is being created here. A wide open space, as well as an idea, so big it can't be contained by any space, for all the people who want a better world to find each other, We are so grateful. If there is one thing I know, it is that the 1% loves a crisis. When people are panicked and desperate and no one seems to know what to do, that is the ideal time to push through their wish list of pro-corporate policies, privatizing education and Social Security, slashing public services, getting rid of the last constraints on corporate power. Amid the economic crisis, this is happening the world over. There is only one thing that can block this tactic, and fortunately, it's a very big thing, the 99%. And that 99% is taking to the streets from Madison to Madrid to say, no, we will not pay for your crisis. That slogan began in Italy in 2008. It ricocheted to Greece and France and Ireland, and finally, it has made its way to the square mile where the crisis began, Wall Street. Why are they protesting? Ask the baffled pundits on TV. Meanwhile, the rest of the world asks, what took you so long? We've been wondering when you were going to show up. And most of all, welcome. Many people have drawn parallels between Occupy Wall Street and the so-called anti-globalization protests that came to world attention in Seattle in 1999. That was the last time a global, youth-led, decentralized movement took direct aim at corporate power, and I am proud to have been part of what we called the movement of movements. But there are important differences, too. For instance, we chose summits as our targets, the World Trade Organization, the International Monetary Fund, the G8. Summits are transient by their nature. They only last a week. That made us transient, too. We would appear, grab world headlines, then disappear. And in the frenzy of hyper-patriotism and militarism that followed the 9/11 attacks, it was easy to sweep us away completely, at least in North America. Occupy Wall Street, on the other hand, has chosen a fixed target, and you have put no end date on your presence here. This is wise. Only when you stay put can you grow roots. This is crucial. It is a fact of the information age that too many movements spring up like beautiful flowers, but quickly die off. It's because they don't have roots, and they don't have long-term plans for how they are going to sustain themselves. So when storms come, they get washed away. Being horizontal and deeply democratic is wonderful. But these principles are compatible with the hard work of building structures and institutions that are sturdy enough to weather the storms ahead. I have great faith that this will happen. Something else this movement is doing right. You have committed yourselves to nonviolence. You have refused to give the media the images of broken windows and street fights they crave so desperately. And that tremendous discipline has meant that, again and again, the story has been the disgraceful and unprovoked police brutality, which we saw more of just last night, and also just last night in this month of November in Oakland. Meanwhile, support for this movement grows and grows, more wisdom. But the biggest difference a decade makes is that in 1999 we were taking on capitalism at the peak of a frenzied economic boom. Unemployment was low, stock portfolios were bulging, the media were drunk on easy money. Back then it was all about startups, not shutdowns. We pointed out that the deregulation behind the frenzy came at a price. It was damaging to labor standards. It was damaging to environmental standards. Corporations were becoming more powerful than governments. And that was damaging to our democracies. But to be honest with you, while the good times rolled, taking on an economic system based on greed was a tough sell, at least in rich countries. 10 years later, it seems as if there aren't any more rich countries, just a whole lot of rich people. People who got rich looting the public wealth and exhausting natural resources around the world. The point is, today everyone can see that the system is deeply unjust and careening out of control. Unfettered greed has trashed the global economy, and it is trashing the natural world as well. We are overfishing our oceans, polluting our water with fracking and deep water drilling, turning to the dirtiest forms of energy on the planet, like the Alberta tar sands. And the atmosphere cannot absorb the amount of carbon we are putting into it, creating dangerous warming. The new normal is serial disasters, economic and ecological. These are the facts on the ground. They are so blatant, so obvious, that it is a lot easier to connect with the public than it was in 1999 and to build the movement quickly. We all know, or at least sense, that the world is upside down. We act as if there is no end to what is actually finite, fossil fuels, and the atmospheric space to absorb their emissions. And we act as if there are strict and immovable limits to what is actually bountiful, the financial resources to build the kind of society we need. The task of our time is to turn this around, to challenge this false scarcity. To insist that we can afford to build a decent, inclusive society, while at the same time respect the real limits to what the earth can take. What climate change means is that we have to do this on a deadline. This time, our movement cannot get distracted, divided, burned out, or swept away by events. This time, we have to succeed. And I'm not talking about regulating the banks and increasing taxes on the rich, though that is important. I am talking about changing the underlying values that govern our society. That is hard to fit into a single media-friendly demand, and it's also hard to figure out how to do it. But it is no less urgent for being difficult. That is what I see happening in this square. In the way you are feeding one another, keeping one another warm, sharing information freely and providing health care, meditation classes, and empowerment training. My favorite sign here says, "I care about you." In a culture that trains people to avoid one another's gaze, to say, "Let them die," that is a deeply radical statement. A few thoughts. In this great struggle, here are some things that don't matter. What we wear. Whether we shake our fists or make peace signs. Whether we can fit our dreams for a better world into a media soundbite. And here are a few things that do matter. Our courage. Our moral compass. How we treat one another. We have picked a fight with the most powerful economic and political forces on the planet. That is frightening. And as this movement grows from strength to strength, it will get more frightening. Always be aware that there will be a temptation to shift to smaller targets, like, say, the person sitting next to you at this meeting. After all, that is a battle that is easier to win. Don't give in to the temptation. I'm not saying don't call one another on stupid stuff, but this time, let's treat one another as if we plan to work side by side in struggle for many, many years to come. Because the task before us will demand nothing less. Let's treat this beautiful movement as if it is the most important thing in the world, because it is. It really is. And that was Naomi Klein. And that was a talk she gave on October 6th to the Occupy Wall Street gathering in its earlier days. And this was the full text of her speech. And a very good one. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.